Welcome to the Talking Tigers podcast with Andy Burcham.
At one point, he was the fastest man in the world. Leroy Burrell broke the world record in the 100 meters on July 6, 1994, at a blistering 9.85 seconds. He was part of the gold medal-winning 4x100 relay team at the 1992 Summer Olympics in Barcelona. Before coming to Auburn as the new track and field head coach, he was the Conference USA Coach of the Year 23 times at Houston and another 11 times in the American Athletic Conference. He is a member of the Philadelphia Southwest Conference and University of Houston Halls of Fame. And now Burrell looks for the same success on the plains. Auburn track and field head coach Leroy Burrell is featured in this Talking Tigers podcast. Very happy to have Auburn's brand new head track and field coach Leroy Burrell on the Talking Tigers podcast. War Eagle, welcome.
War Eagle, thank you for having me.
I would imagine it has been a whirlwind for you because it's not just getting acclimated to work here, but I mean, you've been out and about at the World Championships in Oregon. So, I mean, there hasn't been a whole lot of time for you on this campus, has there?
No, not really. Really came for a couple days on the initial visit here with my family. And I came back, I think, a week later for 3 or 4 days and assembled my staff for, oddly enough, some recruiting visit. And then we all tried to find a place to live and try to figure out a little spot for ourselves in the Auburn community. Some of us went to the World Championships, some went back home and tried to work out getting here. I finally arrived with my family to try to find a place to live and try to work, integrate ourselves into the community. But it's been a wonderful experience. Everybody here has been extremely helpful, and we're really looking forward to really getting started to build our track and field program.
A successful run at Houston, your alma mater, multiple conference championships, All-Americans. If you would, talk about just the process of becoming Auburn's head coach.
It's actually a pretty interesting story because, you know, I contemplated, you know, whether I would at any point in time decide to leave the University of Houston. You know, I mean, I love my alma mater. I mean, she's done everything for me and is everything that I am. You know, but at the same time, I feel like we'd had a great run. And we've gotten as close to winning a national championship as you possibly can. Then life happens. You know, as many people know, you know, I lost my son last August. You know, a lot of those memories would continue to bubble up when I return from my bereavement period. And when I did return, you know, I changed a bit, and things had changed a bit for me. And so, you know, when it was all said and done, you know, I felt like I needed a new opportunity to lead at another place. And it became really apparent to me that the longer I sat in the chair at Houston, the opportunities for those who've been around me and helped me so much and helped me through some of the most difficult times of my life, that opportunity would not be available to them. And so when the opportunity came, and I'll tell you a little story, I didn't intend to apply for a job. And so what I ended up doing is you know, I called Ryan Wakamarka, our swim coach, who actually came from Houston. And I said, Ryan, you know, what's going on with the search at Auburn? He said, you'd be great for the job. And I said, well, you think so? And he says, yeah. And I think they'd love you. And I said, okay, great. And a day later, I got a call. I think maybe 4 or 5 days later, I was offered the position. So, you know, some things are supposed to happen. You know, I think God kind of ordained some things for you. And I had been praying and hoping for an opportunity to, you know, to close the book on those chapters of my life. And it came about, and I'm here. And I think since then, it just feels like many doors and opportunities have opened for me and my family. And quite honestly, I think for Auburn track and field. And so, you know, I feel like this is a little bit more than just me. And I'm really looking forward to really getting down and working and trying to build something special here at Auburn. You know, and I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, mention Coach Bry in this whole process, because, you know, he's been a tremendous asset. And he and I have chatted on a couple of occasions. And I think he did a wonderful job just paving the way And I mean, he's a legend here. Won a national championship here, something I've never done. And I really do feel that they left the program in a really good position with a great deal of talent as a base to build from. So, you know, I have to thank Coach Brian and the staff for that.
If you would, talk about your family.
You know, I have three sons. You know, of course, Cameron passed and would be turning 28 this year. Joshua is 26. Joshua played football at the University of Houston. And Joshua's actually in the USA bobsled pool. He's actually currently in Lake Placid training for the winter season, winter bobsled season. My 13-year-old son, Jaden, who will be attending Auburn schools here shortly. School starts a little earlier here than we
sure
used to.
Does.
And so we've been running around trying to take care of that. And my wife, Michelle, who is Olympic gold medalist, two-time NCAA champion, and a member of the Florida State Hall of Fame. She was on a couple national championships there, formerly Michelle Finn. And so,
sprinter.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And so we're a track and field family. We're a sports family. When we made our initial visit, my son Joshua came with us at the time, and he's like, "Dad, you think I think I have a year of eligibility? You think I could?" I said, "Nah, Josh, I think your clock, you know, I think the sand's run out, you know." So, but he's really excited for me. Jaden is really excited to be here. Oh, and I forgot, you know, I have a 2-year-old granddaughter. Cameron had left us a wonderful granddaughter, Amora. She's actually with us right now. So it's just great. Folks in the department and staff along the way, they've just been tremendous, and I couldn't be happier to be a part of this family.
Ken Harden, the assistant head coach, sprints and hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
Lucina Golding Clark,
mm-hmm.
Of course, Lucina Golding when she ran at Auburn with women's sprints and hurdles. Nick Newman with the jumps, combined events.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Ebel.
Mm-hmm.
Auburn fans know Pat and what he's done with the throws program here. Mm-hmm. And Aaron Kent getting ready for his second year, long distance, cross country. That staff came together pretty quick for you, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. You know, as I mentioned earlier, things just kind of fell in place perfectly for me. When I got the job, I was immediately bombarded with numerous calls and resumes. And oddly, the first person that sent me, that reached out to me that I was ready to talk with was Nick Newman. It's really interesting how this whole thing played out because, you know, at the NCAA meet, I don't know if you've ever experienced it, but, you know, they do all the awards after the meet's over. And the University of Tennessee had just had a wonderful meet. They finished third. And my guys had just happened to be kind of near the Tennessee crew. They were waiting for their trophy. And I've known Ken for quite some time, obviously, with my connection with my wife's connection with Florida State. And Ken recruited Cameron a bit.
Okay.
So I saw Ken, and I said, "Hey, are you going to be all right?" And he said, "I don't know." I said, "Okay, well, I hope it all works out," because I know Ken's a great coach. Fast forward a day or two, obviously, Tennessee makes a decision not to keep Ken and Nick. And, well, Nick reached out to me, I think via Twitter, maybe social media. And I immediately text back, "Hey, I really want to talk with you." So we talked, and we actually met in Eugene. And I was really impressed with him. Obviously, subsequently was named, I think maybe a couple of days before that, was named a National Assistant Coach of the Year. And I was like, okay, this is pretty good. And we hit it off really, really well. And so I felt comfortable there. I had already chatted with the staff and felt really good about Pat. And I felt like Aaron deserved an opportunity to prove himself. And to be honest with you, he had done a really good job of assembling, you know, talent for our distance program, which I think he deserved the opportunity to develop and coach. The first person I reached out to try to bring them in here was Lucina, because I had interviewed Lucina for a position at Houston a couple years ago, but it just didn't work out. Oddly enough, if you ask Lucina about it, she will tell you that earlier the day that I called her, or I messaged her, that she thought if she'd heard about that I'd gotten a position, that if I called her, that she was going to take the job no matter what.
So, how about that?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like one of those things where things just align perfectly.
Yeah.
So I actually texted her and I said, hey, I'd like to talk with you about Auburn. And she texted me. It was a little late that night. As a matter of fact, it was while I was on my initial visit here with my family. And she called, and we chatted. And I was on the phone in the lobby of the Auburn Hotel talking with her, trying to bring her here. The very next day, my first time going into the track and field and soccer building, I met with Coach Bry. And Coach Bry had a picture of Lucina sitting on the chair in his office. And I told Coach, I said, I'm going to hire Lucina. And fast forward, last weekend, Lucina coaches Toby Omison to a world-record 100 hurdles, and I look like a genius.
You grow up in Pennsylvania.
Yes, sir.
Listen, I don't get to talk to a person that at one point was the fastest man mm-hmm. in the world. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, you're the first mm-hmm. that I've talked to that can say that. When did you have an idea that track and field was going to be your avenue?
Probably sometime around the end of my junior year in high school, beginning of my senior year. I was a pretty good, you know, long jumper, triple jumper my junior year in high school, sprinter as well. But my high school coach, Bob Jessen, who I talked to quite a bit, talked to him 2 days ago, as a matter of fact. He was more of a 400, you know, 4x4 guy. He would always say, you know, it's the 100, the sprints are just too risky and you never know what's going to happen. And, you know, but the 400, you know, you can work things out in that race. And I was like, okay, yeah, but that's far. So anyway, I had finally convinced him to let me run the 100 at the Meet of Champs, which was a local meet that they had between Pennsylvania champions and state champions or whatever, New Jersey and Delaware champions. And so at Franklin Field, and I ran against Dennis Mitchell, who was, you know, he was the big deal at that particular year, his senior year. And he only beat me by, I don't know, maybe a tenth or two, I don't even remember what I ran. It was a close race, and my high school coach was like, hey, you are pretty good. And I was like, yeah, well, okay, let's try. Let's do this. And so fast forward to my senior year. You know, I put in a lot more work in the off season and trained a lot, took better care of myself for as far as I knew. Well, I went to the indoor state meet and I won 3 events and got second in a triple jump and lost the state meet single-handedly to Philadelphia Central High School. Then fast forward to the outdoor season, you know, I won 4 events at the state meet and won the state meet single-handedly. And then I think, you know, that's when I started thinking, hey, I can kind of do this.
All right, back up. Your high school won the state championship, and it was you.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. I just wanted to make sure I was clear about that.
Yeah. No, I scored 40, and I think second place team scored 36 or 38 or something that. So
that's impressive.
Well, thank you. Really, during that year, there were a lot of people in the media, you know, local newspaper and whatnot, started to make comparisons to Carl, because Carl is from Willingboro, which is, you know, a short drive across the river from Philadelphia.
Okay.
And Carl's mother actually was still coaching high school track and field at the time. So I remember I did a news story. I was interviewed by one of the local news channels, and they started really making those comparisons.
Had you met him at this point?
No. Okay. No, I had not. Well, you know, this was actually 1984. The summer of 84, I sat on the floor in my grandmother's house and watched the Olympics, and then the comparisons really became stark.
Okay.
Well, about February, my senior year, I got a call from Tom Tellez at the University of Houston, head coach at the University of Houston. And he told me, well, you know, I have a good friend up there, Evelyn Lewis, who coaches in Willingboro. And she told me a bit about you and said that I need to call you, see if you'd be interested in coming to the University of Houston. You know, Carl, we have a guy here named Carl Lewis. And I was like, yeah, I know who he is. So I made a visit. And actually, I struggled a little bit with trying to make the decision whether I wanted to go to Houston or not. My mother wanted me to go.
What choices did you have?
University of Pittsburgh, Ohio State, and LSU and Houston.
All right.
And it really came down to LSU and Houston because my best friend and my high school teammate, was a freshman at LSU at the time. But, you know, at the time, you know, Houston was just, you know, too much of an allure. I mean, there were a lot of good things going on in Houston. That was right around Phi Slammer Jamma, and you know, UH athletics has been pretty right. successful. And you know, at the time, it was, and I'm a city guy too, so it was almost I wouldn't say a no brainer. I struggled a little bit with trying to make the decision where I wanted to go, primarily because of my friends, you know, but. When it really came down to it, it was a no-brainer that I needed to go to Houston.
Obviously, your career at Houston blossoms, national championships, and then the world stage for you. Let's fast forward ahead to the 92 games in Barcelona. Did you take part in the opening ceremonies?
Yes, I did.
What was your view of the guy that shot the arrow that lit the torch? Because on TV, it's one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
It was an unbelievable moment, but... There's so much going on. It's your first experience, and you really feel like one really feels like they're living a dream when that happens. And of course, you know, you're going in opening ceremonies with you know, your track idols, Carl Lewis, Jackie Joyner Kersee, you know, all of those, you know, the big names in track and field. And then here comes the dream team,
yes,
you know,
right.
And you're like, whoa, wow, oh my God, ooh. And you're actually one of the centers. I mean, I was a bit of the center of attention because the year before I'd broken the world record twice, and it was a kind of surreal. But and then you remember the moment, but it was so many other things. It was impressive. Don't get me wrong. The funny thing about the whole Olympic experience from the athlete's perspective is you want to enjoy it, you know, you want to be the fan, but you really can't. Mm-hmm. You have to really narrow your focus to your performance and your days of competition. And so you don't really get to soak it in. And I think that's one of the, you know, unfortunate things about that experience. Because
right.
everybody else has all these great adventures, you know, with the games. Like my parents and my family who were there, they, wow, this Barcelona's an awesome city. I was like, wow, there it is. Wow. I got practice, you know.
Right. So,
but hey, we were. You do? I can't go. You know? I run in 2 days.
Yes.
You know, because everything that you do, a lot of people don't realize it, but it's a tremendous amount of pressure. Because everything that you do has to be centered on trying to maximize your ability in that very short period of time.
One of the things that always strikes me is that for many of the Olympians, this is their one, maybe, and only chance that they get.
Mm-hmm.
Everything leads up to one moment, so to speak, for you. From a mental standpoint, how do you handle that? How did you handle that?
It's a great deal of pressure because, you know, it can make or break you. You know, it can make or break your future.
Right.
I think in my case, I had the huge moment the year before in Tokyo at the World Championships. And, you know, I ran the race of my life. It's just that there was this guy named Carl Lewis who ran an even better one. And it was to me, kind of bridging to that, but to me, that was one of those moments where reality just hits immediately. You cross the line, you look up at the scoreboard, and you realize, man, I got beat. I ran 988, but man, I lost. You know, and then you look down, and Carl's a great friend and a big mentor and training partner, and so I was happy. But at the moment when all of the cameras turn, and you're the guy, they're like, move out the way, you know, and it's like, wait a minute, I ran 988, but. That's the reality that you run into oftentimes with the Olympics, you know, and you don't really see the things on the periphery through the lens. That's a challenge, and that's what that one moment. And it doesn't really matter that it's your moment as well. The guy on the podium, the guy in the gold medal position is going to get that attention. And sometimes it's a big challenge to deal with.
92 games, you're part of a fabulous 4x100 relay with Carl Lewis, Mike Marsh, and Dennis Mitchell, who you talked about earlier that you had faced in high school. Mel Rosen was one of the coaches for the United States.
Yes.
I remember there was a lot of drama around that relay for the United States.
You know, it's kind of funny because that's what the perception was. You know, I think the reality was, you know, we were the six guys were chosen for the team, and four of us were going to go out and run. Mark Witherspoon, a training partner and good friend of mine, ended up rupturing his Achilles tendon in the semifinal, I believe. Actually, I think it might have been the first round. Then it's kind of funny. You know, a lot of people start talking about controversy. But it really wasn't any controversy. Okay. It was Carl was the next man, and we went to prepare to go and compete. Every single one of those stories is a lot. It's a lot less than what it's made out to be.
Okay. You know,
we didn't run very well in the first round. We had run together, Carl, Dennis, Dennis Mitchell, myself, and Mike, of course, three of my training partners were on the team. And Coach Rosen wanted us to do one thing, and we were like, well, wait a minute. We've been doing this together for a while, so maybe we ought to stick. Well, I think let's be a little safe. And it's like, no, let's just be safe and do what we've always done.
Yeah.
You know, and so we kind of huddled up and said, okay, look, this is what we're going to do. It wasn't like a full-out revolt, I guess you'd say, but it was we'd been through it, and we knew what we needed to do. And I think we practiced a little bit maybe the day before and went out, and it worked out. You know, we set a world record 37:40, and it stood for quite some time.
Do you remember that moment? That moment when you know you're a gold medalist at the Olympics?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you cross the line, it's an immediate impact. You know, it's the kind of thing that no one's going to take away from you. It is the shining moment of your career. You know, one thing I remember kind of that was bouncing around my head at that moment was, you know, when they're playing the national anthem, I couldn't help but think about a couple of things. One, I can't believe they're playing the national anthem in my honor. It's like the thing I've seen on TV. But being the competitor that I am, I couldn't help but think, my God, it was supposed to happen a couple of days ago in the 100, and I blew it. You know, yeah. So those two things were bouncing around my mind.
What leg did you run?
I ran second leg.
Second leg, all right. The first time you beat Carl Lewis in a 100?
The Goodwill Games in Seattle in 1990.
What was that moment like for you? Because he had been the guy.
Yeah.
You talked about running 10:88 and looking up, and Carl had just edged you.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to finally beat that guy?
Well, I mean, it was huge because the Goodwill Games at the time, it was basically like a big championship. It was in Seattle, and there was a huge, you know, stadium. It was a kind of a made-for-TV Olympic-style competition. I mean, I took it seriously. You know, obviously, I think Carl was pretty good at, you know, kind of, you know, turning it on and off. And I don't know if he was completely off, but I know he wasn't, you know, at his best form at that moment. And so, you know, I thought I ran a pretty solid race. You know, it was a pretty close race, and I actually think, if I remember correctly, I think I might have come back and beat and kind of gotten in front of Carl right at the end, which is really unusual. You know, it's more about the guy slowing down, and that's usually more of a fitness issue than anything else.
Okay.
You know, so I think I kind of got in front of him and leaned and won, and I think it was a bit of a surprise to everyone because, you know, Carl didn't lose very often. And so it's like, oh, who's this guy? You know, I was in the throes of a good 2.5 year mm-hmm. run where I don't think I lost very many races, maybe two races or so during that time frame.
Right.
And it wasn't as if I were a normal competitor to Carl. I saw Carl every day. So it wasn't like it was that much of a surprise to me. Whereas, I mean, when you trained on the track at Houston with the guys that we had, if you could compete at a high level at that practice, then going somewhere else,
sure,
competing somebody else was easy.
July 6, 1994,
mm-hmm.
you reset your world record, 9.85 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
For you,
mm-hmm.
was that a perfect race?
Just about, yes. Yeah.
Other than the time itself, Coach,
mm-hmm.
for you as a competitor,
mm-hmm.
what was a perfect race for you?
Well, I mean, the execution, obviously. I mean, and that was a well-executed race. I probably could have gotten a little bit better start. But in general, it was probably the absolute peak of my ability to perform. So, and it was a culmination of all of the things that I had done, you know, with myself mentally and physically to be able to perform at that level. And I actually knew that I was going to run fast that day. it was confirmation that I'd done the things that I needed to do. Like, I think everybody's career, and most people's career, you know, you have phases. You have a phase where you just got all of this raw ability, and you might not really know what to do with it. And so early on, that's where I was. And then at one time, you're just kind of competing. You know, you're just a raw competitor at a certain point, and I'd gone through that phase. Well, I kind of hit that third phase where you're like, well, I'm got this ability. I'm a raw competitor, but I need some refinement. And by the time I'd gotten to that particular performance, I had worked on refining myself to become the best sprinter that I could be. And a lot of people probably think, well, you'll just run fast, you know, but no, it's a little bit more than that. And that was a culmination of all the things I'd done. You know, I'd kind of taken control of my diet and, you know, my training, my focus, the mental game. You know, I put some extra work in. I was just in really, really peak condition and did some extra things that I knew I needed to do to perform better. And I went over to Lausanne that day and got it done. And then that was a change in my life, too. I kind of settled down with Michelle, and we just had Cameron, and we were about to be married, and everything was on the right track, and so to speak, and I got on the track and did the right thing. So it was just one of those perfect moments. But the bad part about it is about a month later, I got hurt, and then that's when things started to fall apart competitive.
You came back from a torn ACL.
Yes.
And late in your career, you had Achilles trouble, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people don't realize that I was a really good long jumper. You know, I was a two-time NCAA champion in the long jump. I jumped 8:40, which is 27.8. Right now, if I were a long jumper nowadays, 27.8, I'd be a superstar. So I actually quit long jumping because there were a whole bunch of 8:40 guys, Carl and Larry Myricks and Mike Powell and Joe Green and a lot of there was a really golden era of the long jump at that point. So I injured myself long jumping my freshman year in college, and so that's where the injury came from. I actually got back and won a couple of championships at the college level, but beyond that, I decided it just wasn't worth it for me to continue on.
How did you take all of this incredible success as a competitor into coaching and that success? Because it's two completely different disciplines.
Mm-hmm. I threw almost everything out the window. Because quite honestly, I think the reason why a lot of athletes have a difficult time transitioning to coaching, because they can't get away from their personal experience. And in some cases, athletes were extraordinary talents that were able to, as I mentioned, you know, kind of go through those phases where you got the talent, then you got to hone it and all those things, you know, but not realize that the experience, somebody else's experience is completely different from yours. You can, as a former elite athlete, refer back to your experience and use your experiences as, you know, maybe talking points or whatever term you want to use to try to assist a young athlete in trying to go through that experience. But you still have to be a teacher. And if you do not hone your skills as a teacher and learn how to relate with student athletes at their level, it doesn't matter how good you are. And as a matter of fact, in some cases, it becomes a little of a hindrance, because once a student athlete, you know, thinks that or gets a feeling that you can't communicate what they need, then they'll go find somebody else. So I don't talk about, you know, what I used to do or what I could do very, very much. I always start with, I got to teach them first. And so that's what I've always tried to do.
Who was a coaching influence or mentor for you as a coach?
Oh, well, obviously, Tom Tellez at Houston. And even Mike Takaha as well, the sprint coach at Houston at the time. A lot of, you know, my mindset and philosophy as far as coaching is concerned comes from there. Vince Anderson, who was the longtime sprint coach at the University of Tennessee. Well, he was actually a graduate assistant at Houston before going to Tennessee and then onward to Texas A&M has been a mentor of mine for many, many years. And I'm just one of those guys who sits back and just observes, you know, how people go about their business. And so, as I started coaching, I had an idea what kind of workouts, what kind of plan I wanted to. But then you have to think about how do you want to run your team? How do you want to run your program? And I've always looked to the best in the business, and Pat Henry at Texas A&M, and Mike Holloway at Florida, and Dennis Shaver at LSU. You know, just kind of just watch. I wouldn't say I'd ask a lot of questions. I just kind of watch and see how those guys handle things. And I always made it a point to sit after the NCAA championship, you know, to kind of sit and watch the presentation, the trophy presentation, and listen to the things that the student athletes and the coaches said. And it was always this big component of team and we, and you hear it all the time. I had to do it for my team. I didn't want to let my team down. And so I was always one to try to create that culture, you know, in my program. Once we were able to do that at Houston, that's when our program really started to take off. It has to be a little bit more than just I got to line up and long jump or throw the jab or run the 5K or whatever it is. You know, it needs to be I've got to make my contribution to the team effort. And that's really what I'm looking forward to building and returning to Tiger Track and Field.
What do you think is the biggest challenge for Leroy Burrell as the first year head track and field coach at Auburn University?
Got to change the culture. You know, I mean, just flat out, we have to change the culture. You know, somewhere along the way, for whatever reason, you know, that culture of we turned into a culture of me. And the experience is not very comfortable for the student athlete as well, because most athletes come to a program, they want to be a part of a good team, but they also don't know what it takes. You know, so you have to build that culture, and you have to you got to do a little mutual sacrifice, you know, shared suffering, I guess you can say. You know, every team goes through that. And then I think there becomes a point where, you know, there's a little bit of a actualization. You know, you kind of get some people who don't want to deal with it, don't want to be a part of it, will find themselves, you know, either, you know, moved out or pushed out, or they'll just decide it isn't for me. But once you get the right group, you know, in the room with the right mindset, you can get a group of young people to do some really, really great things, even in the culture that we live in now.
Your relationship with Carl Lewis?
Oh, Carl's a great friend. As a matter of fact, probably for the first couple of weeks that, you know, I was here, we talked almost every day. You know, Carl's a great friend, great mentor. We've learned a lot from each other. I think, you know, I would not be the athlete, would not have been the athlete that I was if it wasn't for Carl. You know, he was when you got the greatest of all time, you know, on the track with you, and you're a pretty good chameleon, you just morph, you know. A lot of people would, and I've heard people say this, would see this as a bit of a threat, you know. Yeah, Carl's a big fish, you know. And some people, oh, I don't want to go, and I want, it's too big. I was like, why not? You know, that's easy, you know. I don't want to start from scratch, man. Why don't I start where he is, and then I can try to take it to, you know, my spot. And so that's kind of the experience that I had with Carl as a competitor. Carl was an auto mine in high school, to, you know, and early on in college as well. And to, we were a mentor, a mentee type situation, then a peer situation, and then come to find out, you know, later on in his life, I'm his boss, you know. So we've gone through the whole phase. I mean, I don't think there are very few people who've kind of gone through the whole spectrum of you know, relationships that Carl and I have gone through, and I think that makes our relationship really unique.
Can't wait for what you and your staff and this program become at Auburn. We welcome you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to the full Auburn experience. I can't help but say it's been great for me and my family. War Eagle.
War Eagle. For Leroy Burrell and the Talking Tigers podcast, I'm Andy Burcham. Be strong and be courageous. War Eagle.